We head up to the store's vast third-floor ballroom, which company officials and mine guards treated as a clubhouse of sorts. We peer into a small wing off the main room, which Joy Lin, the store's owner and its star tour guide, refers to as the shoe room.
It originally started out as the smoking room or the waiting room for the gentlemen. But we've had multitudes of women come in and tell us, as little girls, they can remember their mothers coming to the company store. And one of the things that a lot of the more lovely ladies had to do was come upstairs. Some of the young girls had the stories shared by their mothers, stating that they would be escorted into the shoe room. There would be a selected guard who would be waiting for them. And they would receive a brand new pair of shoes with no accountability to that other than to perform whatever service the guard wished to have in lieu of pay. We had one woman in particular share with us that her mother was a young girl about 25 years old and bought her first pair of shoes here. And the woman's entire life, those shoes remain in a shoebox on her closet shelf, never to be worn, and she refused to wear another pair of shoes the entire life. She made her shoes out of cardboard, newspapers, and twine.
Now, let's just stop right there. The Esau story and the story of the shoe room suggest an institutionalized practice of forced sexual servitude that was a part of company policy. If the abuse happened that way, it changes radically our understanding of coal camp culture. And not everyone's jumping to conclusions.
It is disturbing to myself and those who came before me from that area to think that the females of our family could have been forced into that situation without us reacting.
That's Dr. Paul Rakes. He was born in Scarborough near the Whipple Company store, where he drew his first payday from the New River Company. After working 20 years underground as a coal miner, he earned a PhD in history and is now a professor at WVU Tech. He primarily studies coal mine disasters, but more recently he's been looking at life in the coal camps, particularly violence as it occurred there.
Miners would not tolerate violations of their concept of what was fair treatment. They were not chattel slaves. They were what TAMS called a hard-bitten lot. Very independent in spirit, quick to take offense. If they are politically and economically disabled to some extent, they are not culturally and socially disabled. That's the difference. Those men I know from years of research, family unit and unit of friends, would have done one of two things. They would have either left that camp as soon as they knew this kind of behavior was required or a potential danger, or they would have reacted to it violently.
Don't look now, but it did come out in a violent way.
And that's Wes Harris, whose background is in sociology and labor organizing.
Okay, Blair Mountain was about the union card, but it was also about settling the scores and solving the Esau problem and the way the script was administered, the entire social system and the cultural system that was imposed on the miners. If you think Blair Mountain was just about a union card, well, you're sure giving these guys a lot of credit for loving their union, and I love my union, but not that much.
And it is true that some of the battles that unfolded during the mine wars are still shrouded in mystery. We have to acknowledge the unexplained uprisings that are still unaccounted for, and that perhaps the miners were exercising their agency in ways we don't yet understand. Still, Rakes has poured through stacks of criminal court proceedings in Fayette County and says he's never come across anything like the Esau story. And as a historian, that's troubling.
I would require some significant documentation. If this kind of behavior was common, was actually institutionalized, part of the operating procedure, you could not keep all these things quiet. Some highly self-reliant coal miner would have killed someone over it. It would have ended up in Fayette County Court.
I say it's laughable.
Wes Harris.
The culture was you do not talk.
Wes travels to fairs and festivals around the state, where he sells his book about the Battle of Blair Mountain. He says the story of Esau Scripp has come to him unprompted.
Usually it's in terms of grandpa told me or my grandmother had to take the Esau. That's a phraseology, had to take the Esau. A gal that I, agreed not to name, but she sat across the table from me and said, I can tell you this stuff was real because my grandmother had to take the ESOL, but my mother doesn't even know. And so that's how tightly held it was. One gentleman said, yeah, I heard about ESOL from my grandfather. That was kind of like the cousin every family had and nobody wants to talk about.
Could it be that roughly 100 years later, ESOL is becoming public? If so, it's likely too late to document firsthand accounts. Joy says she has documents that substantiate the ESOL and shoeroom stories, a letter and a list of women's names, but won't release them because she says she fears for their privacy. It's been difficult to get any kind of documentation from Joy. The only thing that's a fact, she maddeningly tells me over and over, is that the building exists. I've talked to other historians about it, and most equivocate. There may be validity to the claims, they say, but they need evidence. For Dr. Rakes, what we can see and what we do know is tragedy enough.
What history has shown us that cannot be challenged is that the reality of the loss of civil rights, constitutional rights in coal camps, economic restrictions that coal miners live under, that's a tragedy. And it was a tragedy for my grandfather, who ended up with a broken back in coal mining and lived in poverty the rest of his life. And I'm not taking anything away from that. By the same token, I'm not applying that to these other social standards.
But Wes says that part of a historian's job is to go out and look for the evidence when something as potentially important as this surfaces.
The historians of the previous eras didn't do their homework, didn't ask the right questions, so we don't have the records that we would like to have. Doesn't mean it didn't happen, it means we didn't do our job well, and that includes me.
Tune in tomorrow morning as we further unravel the haunted history of Whipple Company Store. For now, I'm Catherine Moore, reporting from Whipple, West Virginia.